The winter of 2014 will be remembered by those on the west coast of Ireland as the most savage and living memory. Two huge Atlantic swells came in January and February of that year. In northwest Mayo, under the shadow of Croagh-Patrick, Marcia Meran, a 36-year-old international best-selling author, was struggling to finish her most ambitious book. At the same time, she was facing and losing her biggest battle.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hiya.
Sorry for bothering you.
You're grand.
My name is Jason. I'm making a radio program with RT Radio 1.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, did you live here last year?
Yes.
Did you know the lady who was living next door to you at
yes,
all?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to come in for a cup of tea or
would
something?
You mind? Thanks.
Not at all.
Marcia's neighbours in the small seaside village of Lecanby don't have much to say about Marcia. She's someone they never got to know. From January to April of 2014, she lived in a chalet across from the local pub. But it's as if she was a ghost amongst them, rarely seen and rarely heard from.
Therese Staunton from the pub in Lecanby, Staunton's Bar, at the foot of Croagh-Patrick around the shores of Clubay. Were acquainted with Marcia simply through a chance meeting. She was renting a house locally and we would see her sitting on the park bench just opposite the pub from time to time, and in inclement weather sometimes she was able to pick up the Wi-Fi from our connection, so we invited her in several times just as a courtesy because the weather was so inclement, and she seemed like a lonely figure. We didn't interact very much, but just a simple invitation, and she politely declined, and that was about as much interaction as we had with Marcia.
On Wednesday, April 30th, 2014, just after 1:15 in the afternoon, Gardaí in Westport found Marcia Meran dead inside her rubber-strewn bungalow. The circumstances of her death left many questions. At the end of that year, the coroners would find that Marcia died from diseases unknown, with an open verdict recorded. How did Marcia come to die lying face down in her bedroom, naked from the waist with just a cardigan on, in a seemingly self-imposed isolation? Scattered throughout the chalet were pans of liquid, later identified as urine. So who was Marcia Meran, and how had she come to spend almost a third of her young life here in Ireland? Less than 10 years earlier, Marcia was coming to the Irish public's attention when she appeared on RTE's The Afternoon Show, promoting her first book, Pomegranate Soup.
Born in Iran on the eve of the Islamic Revolution, our next guest was destined to live a life full of adventure and upheaval. We'll talk about that in a minute. Having lived in Argentina, Australia and America, she came to the Irish shores for love. With all these fantastic experiences, she's written a beautiful book based on fiction but immersed in the culture and flavours of Iran. Marcia Meran, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
I made it's your surname sound like Iran.
Yeah.
It's Meran.
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 Like Morn.
Pomegranate Soup.
Yes.
Fantastic cover.
It is. It's beautiful.
It is. Beautiful. I love
red.
The colours.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the book in a minute, but first I want to talk about you. I'm fascinated with your background. You were born in Iran.
Yes.
And you and your family had to leave in a hurry, to say the least. What happened?
Well, the Islamic Revolution hit in 1979, and I was two back then. And my family was from a very small minority called Baha'is, which is a religious group. And they were really, you know, in danger constantly. And when the revolution hit, it was worse for them. We escaped. We escaped basically on the eve of the revolution. We were in danger no matter what. Mm. So we left, and we left to go to Argentina.
You're there with your mom and dad in the picture.
Yes,
there.
That's
you're
Iran.
You're a little baby.
Yeah.
And tell me that. I mean, Iran sounds, I've never been, it sounds like a fascinating country.
Today, millions of families are being displaced through war. They seek desperate ways to improve their lives in new countries. Long before Ireland became her home, Marcia's family fled their homeland, spending a lifetime wandering the globe. For Marcia, this set the seeds of an odyssey better measured in continents than countries. And in a way, this search for home has defined them. we find her father, Abbas, working as an artist in southern Australia.
Okay, Marsha was born in 1977. It's the time that the revolution in Iran was just beginning to happen. When she was born, after 3 days, we brought her from hospital to our home. And we had bought a music box with Ferrelli's, part of Ferrelli's, Beethoven music, and we always put it there at night to listen, and she listen and go to sleep. So let's go to my studio, which fortunately is not too far from my house, or my kitchen actually, which is my favorite place. And yes, this is my studio. And let's go inside to see what we can find. And this is my palace, this is my place of refuge. I come here and paint. However, I haven't painted for a while, and since April 2014, when Marsha died.
Two outstanding features came to define Marsha as a woman. The first was her constant moving. The second, her love of food. These two elements were at the core of her writing, and both can be traced to her early life. Pomegranate Soup was Marsha's first novel. Published when she was just 28, it became a bestseller, translated into 15 languages, on top of the book charts in a number of countries. After leaving Iran at just the age of 2, her family settled in Argentina, and it's there that Marsha's love affair with Persian food began.
You know, as soon as we got there, my parents opened up this Middle Eastern cafe in South America, and I was put into a Celtic school, St. Andrew's, which we wore kilts and there was bagpipes.
Picture of you there.
There's a picture of me, the little brown girl in the middle. That's basically me.
Not standing out or anything.
No, it's sea of blondes.
I know. Sea of blondes and pale skin. So tell me, you went to Argentina. At the young age of 4, you're speaking 3 languages.
3 languages, yes. My parents made me say goodnight in Spanish, Farsi, which is Persian, and English.
So it would be, how do you say goodnight?
Shab becher, buenas noches, and good night.
Yeah. So from Argentina, another upheaval you had to leave.
Yes. Again, bad timing, a bad country to be in. Economy fell apart. My parents lost their money. They decided, let's just go to America.
After just 4 years in Argentina, and at the age of 6, Marsha and her family moved to America. 8 years later, she was on the move again, this time to Australia. For anyone, let alone a child, this was a transient way of life. A New York Times article penned by Marsha in 2005 gives some insight into the legacy of a lifetime's displacement.
Revolutions come in all varieties. For me, the biggest one came at 14, when my parents announced they were divorcing. Somewhere along the line, somewhere between chopping root vegetables and learning to say, "Let Mary Kay make your day," their marriage had lost ground. My mother and I went to live in Australia, where my grandparents migrated after the revolution in Iran. Australia struck me as barren. I don't think I was fully aware of what was wrong, why I felt so unmoored in Australia. So in 1997, at 19, I left for New York with about $200 in my pocket. I told myself that I was seeking new adventures, but I think I was looking for a place to call home.
Some years after Marsha's move to Australia with her mother and younger brother, her mum returned to the US, leaving Marsha and her brother with their father, Abbas. Marsha's relationship with her mother never fully recovered.
It's interesting listening to you talk, how it reminds me how strongly food... It's not just that it's food, it's when it's linked to memory. I mean, your memory of your mother making elephant ears for you, you know, and I'm sure everything you describe, I'm sure, is linked to some strong memory for you. I mean, that's what makes food so magical.
Yes. It's memory of home, memory of mother, I think, you know, comfort. And there's nothing as primary, as fundamental as that first bite your mom gives you, you know, that mushed up, you know, spoonful of food that you get to chew for the first time. Everything is back to that. I mean, you know, at every party, everyone gathers around the kitchen. There's a reason behind it. Absolutely. I think it comes back to mother, always.
Marcia's search for home ended on the west coast of Mayo, her nearest relative 3,000 miles away. During her early 20s in New York, Marcia blossomed into a beautiful woman. Brown, almond-shaped eyes, sallow skin, and long dark hair. When her body was found, it was reported to be lying in a peaceful-looking manner, without any physical trauma or injury, but in an advanced state of decay. It is suspected that she lay inside the bedroom of her chalet, undiscovered, for at least a week. Her last reported sighting, some 2.5 months previous. Marcia had come to La Canvie, on the Atlantic fringe of West Mayo, to separate herself from the world, to give herself the space and seclusion to write. A man who knows this area better than most is local poet Paddy Guthrie.
Looking down here now on La Canvie village, you can see yourself the different colours of the ocean. There's an azure blue that's just jumping out, a cornflower blue, you know. A Paul Henry sky, if you've ever seen a Paul Henry painting, blue and cloudy, you know. That's not your usual for here, you know. The usual sky here is a gunmetal grey and it hangs low. In the evenings, when you get the light of the sun going down, it slants across the bay and it gives it its own particular blue. It's a Clew Bay blue. It's a blue that all of us around here are familiar with. It hangs in the air in the evenings. Then you've got Inishlier Lighthouse, absolutely shining like a gem across the bay. Always the welcoming sight, you know. When you're coming back in the road from Lewisburg, it's one of the first things you spot, that lighthouse, and you know you're across just level with the mouth of the bay and you're heading in along the La Canvie Road into Dlash, down into Murrisk, and then along the West Road into Westport. Absolutely phenomenal. Classic. Where would you get it? Patchwork. A patchwork, you know. We're underneath Crowpatrick as well, the mountain. Croak on Eagla, it was called in ancient times. The Hill of the Eagle. The mountain resonates, you know, it's got a healing energy. For all healing, there's a price to pay. You get the healing, but you leave a part of you here. And I think that's what it is about this place. It endears itself to people. It draws you in. But you have to be of a certain, how can I put it, a certain type of person to live with the elements that we have here. You can have four seasons, sometimes six seasons in one day. You know, it throws everything at you. And if you're of a melancholy disposition, let us say, the darkness of the landscape can weave a spell on you, you know.
It was no accident that Marcia finally chose Mayo as her home. Besides the inspiration she found at Crowpatrick, in New York City, she met a Mayo man from Turlock. Marcia, age 19, was working as a waitress in a bar down the street from Ryan's Irish Pub, where Christopher Collins was behind the counter.
She tried to get deep with me straight away. It was like about my background. Well, she started off with the whole Sweet 16. She was infatuated with that song when she was in Argentina in Buenos Aires. And she said, did I know it? And I said, yes. And I think I played it on the jukebox for her. And then she came to sit at the bar and we just talked and talked and talked and talked and talked and talked for hours. And then she started playing, you know, cool, like, you know, that 4:30 in the morning thing where, like, you know, you're not getting any, you know, attention from me, so I'm going to go home. And that was it. And she, you know, I played cool and I said good night. And that was it. And then she was playing hardball, so I decided to switch it up, make her a little jealous. And 10 minutes later, she told the girl where to go, and that was it. She was strong enough to say, hey, that's going to be my man. So that was kind of how it happened.
For many of us, the decision to move country or change jobs happens rarely and is fraught with anguish and carefully considered. For Marcia, a wanderer since she was 2, life-changing decisions were no big deal.
We met on a Friday, moved in together Sunday, engaged about 3 weeks later, moved to Australia about 4 months after that. It was like July, I think, of 98. She said to me that she was moving back to Australia. And she said, well, you know, if I'm important enough for you, you got to go with me. So smitten that I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. So I moved to Australia with her. And then we did a year in Australia. And then she said, well, I'm moving to Ireland now. And I was like, okay.
Newlyweds Chris and Marcia arrived to Ireland in 1998 and settled in Dublin. Marcia found work as a receptionist at Film Base in Temple Bar, where she first met Barbara Henkes.
So she was quite a beautiful-looking girl, full of energy, you know, so definitely was a good person to have in reception. She was very welcoming and, you know, fun to be around, great sense of humour. So she fitted right in into kind of the organisation that we were, you know, she got on well with everybody.
She was a sociable person, friendly?
Oh, very sociable, very friendly, great laugh, great stories. From New York, when she was talking about the time when she was kind of 19 and arrived in New York, and she's a great storyteller. She was very sociable. We definitely had some great nights in Dublin going out, and she was easygoing, and yeah, she's good fun to be around.
When she was in Film Base, did you know that she wanted to be a writer?
It was something she talked about and she wanted. It was an aspiration, something she thought about. She read an awful lot. Like she kind of went through library books and all the time she had a pile of books beside her. So, you know, like she devoured books. She read an awful lot, you know, so that's really... So she definitely... And she talked about it. She wanted to do it, wanted to write a book.
After about a year in Ireland, Marcia came home one evening, told Chris she wanted to move back to Australia. Every year, for the early part of the noughties, Marcia would get itchy feet and want to move country. For 7 consecutive years, they moved their home between Ireland, Australia, and New York. Looking back at this pattern now, it seems that Marcia was in search of something.
You know, common sense would have told most people, all right, enough is enough. I mean, I have had more 40-foot containers outside my places than anybody can imagine. I was always about New York. I always loved New York. I didn't want to move from New York. And again, when you're in a relationship for your partner, sometimes you give up the things you love the most. Further things you love the most.
Throughout this restless period of movement, there was one constant in Marcia's life. Her relentless ambition to become a writer. This drive paid off when she struck a 3-book deal.
I don't know, talking to her later about it, I don't think it was that easy. I think she had written the book and she was submitting it to publishers, and I think they sent it to a lot of publishers. But when she got it, it was a fantastic deal, and it was a 3-book deal, and it was a big publishing house. And yeah, I remember that she did call me at the time and she was just over the moon.
Her debut and biggest seller was Pomegranate Soup, which she set in the fictional village of Ballinacroe, County Mayo, a village that was underneath Croagh-Patrick.
I'm Emer Martin, and I'm a writer, a novelist. The Irish Times asked me to interview Marcia. And I suppose my husband's Persian, like Marcia. I had that connection. I think that's why they sent me down. And then when I got down there, there were more connections. She was standing there among boxes, and I was standing here in County Meath among boxes. So we had that connection of constantly moving as well. It was a nice little house she had there. Everything was up to the walls and boxes. There was no sense of permanence about it. Struck me as a very joyful time in her life. And she was about to publish this book, which was her heart's desire, her dream. Her career was coming together. Everything was falling into the place. But she was very much giddy and in love. Very warm and welcoming. She struck me as very beautiful. Beautiful looking girl, especially when you see in the Mayo countryside, Persians are so exotic looking with her, you know, almond-shaped brown eyes and her whole demeanour. She was exotic in Castlebar, I'd have to say, and I think she enjoyed that. She enjoyed the contrast of it. But I still kept thinking, Mayo, what would you be doing in Mayo and living in Mayo? I met her in the summer months and it was the most beautiful day. The sun was shining in and you'd think everything could be perfect when the sun shines in Mayo. But then the sun doesn't always shine in Mayo. She was an exotic woman. I mean, even to be a writer and an artist sets you out. It sets you apart anywhere you go. But also there is the fact that she had married into an Irish family. So she was part of things, but yet apart.
Marcia's writing in her first book, Pomegranate Soup, gave little indication that just 9 years later, her life would end in the same place that provided inspiration for her debut novel. Back then, her future was bright and her writing hopeful. The book, reflective of her own journey and those things that mattered to her most, the search for home and the joy of food.
Marcia Maron grew up surrounded by the evocative power of food. These days, she lives in Ireland, where she wrote the novel Pomegranate Soup. It's the story of Iranian sisters who turn a small Irish town on its ear with their sensual Iranian cooking.
The sun began to set over Clew Bay as Marjan leaned back with her tea and marveled at the similarities between the Lunasa festival and her own version of the pomegranate myth. Marjan liked to believe the old stories of Persian soothsayers who held a different vision for the tart fruit's purpose in life. She liked to remember that above all else, above all the unfortunate connotations of death and winter, the pomegranate was, and always would be, the fruit of hope, of new things to come. It had shown even her that some of the best recipes are the unwritten ones, the ones that happen when you pour yourself a glass of Shiraz and put on a Billie Holiday record. Because like it or not, life will go on with or without you, forever blooming in someone else's back garden, giving flavor to yet another pot of pomegranate soup. Yes, that's how she would like to think of that particular sweetness, the myriad seedlings that could only really be the flower of new beginnings.
The book propelled Marcia into a world of book tours, readings, and media interviews. Here she is in 2006, appearing on US radio.
I married an Irishman, first of all. I've been married to him for 8 years, so I'm Irish in a lot of ways now. But the two cultures have a lot of similarities, and there's the language, the love of the language. They both have the love of poetry. The Irish family is very strong, and so is the Persian family. So I began to see there's something the same. But as far as having these three Iranian sisters come into this town and be different, the big difference between the Irish and the Iranians is the food. Big difference. You know, Irish people are great drinkers. Iranians cannot hold their alcohol. And vice versa when it comes to food. You know, Iranians, their cuisine is one of their cornerstones of their culture. It's considered a great art. And what I discovered living in Ireland, living with an Irishman, is that food is just there for sustenance. You know, it's not there for flavor. It's not there for enjoyment or pleasure. And, you know, Ireland has changed a lot in the last 10 years. And, you know, they've discovered a lot of cuisines and a lot of ways of making even traditional Irish food to make it more interesting. But I think in the 80s especially, it wasn't something that was the norm. And, you know, it's a nice, gentle clash, you know?
For all the joy and happiness that the book brought, it was a hard-won journey for Marcia. who had struggled with the pressures that come with writing. For her husband, Chris, the publication and success of the book came as a relief.
She was Marcia again. I mean, she was so happy. It was the happiness was like, you know, it was like when we first met. It was like there was no care in the world. The spirit was like, we had fun. We had a lot of fun. And then the book was launched in Ireland, and, you know, and then she went to Poland to launch it, and England was amazing. And, like, you know, we had our marketing ploy, and then Italy was, I think, the first country that took her out on a tour and brought both of us out and paid for us and brought us out to Italy. And, you know, that was exciting, and she was a big deal out there. She was, because she was this smoking hot Persian writer, and, you know, paparazzi used to chase her down. I mean, she got the whole fame thing was happening there, you know? And she was on TV shows and every magazine, and she did, like, really, really well over there. Like, they loved her.
Shortly after that, Marcia and Chris settled in Brooklyn. And in the New York Times article Marcia wrote around then, it seemed that the success of the book and this latest move had brought some sense of permanence to her life.
My husband's name is Christopher, same as the patron saint of travelers. Christopher and I lived for 2 years in a cottage in the west of Ireland. But now our days abroad are over, and we're back in the United States. We've settled in Brooklyn, where, of all the places I've been, I feel most myself. I understand Brooklyn in my bones. The juxtaposition of so many voices, so many souls, so many foods, so many cultures. It is in this most American of cities that I've chosen to set down roots. Because it seems to me no other place better embodies the world. When people ask me where I'm from, I say I'm Persian, born in Iran. I write and dream in English. I curse in Spanish. And after a few pints of Guinness, I dance a mighty Irish jig. And when people ask me where I live, I tell them Brooklyn. Brooklyn is my home.
It was around this time that life began to take on a different hue for Marcia. Some years earlier, she had lost her American green card, one of the conditions to hold on to that card that she had been granted as a child was to enter the US at least once every 2 years. Her search for home had, ironically, left her without the option of putting down roots in the one place she now wanted to call home. Around this time, Marcia had been granted Irish citizenship, and perhaps that acceptance is what eventually drew her back. During the period of 2006 to 2009, Marcia's life began to unravel. Her second book failed to reach the heights of the first, and due to only having a US holiday visa, her time in the States and with her husband Chris became less and less. On one particular visit, their relationship came to a head.
Before she came back, she said some not so nice things that, you know, weren't true. And it was very, very hard to swallow. So she came back and she got off the airplane, and she said something that, you know, when you haven't seen somebody in so long and you've missed them so much, you know, you expect a little hug and a whatnot, but that's not the reaction I got. So, I mean, not going into it, but it just wasn't the reaction I was looking for. So that night, I was like, it's just not fair, so we need to take a break. And that's how that kind of happened.
Chris and Marcia eventually divorced in 2008. For the next 6 years, Marcia would wander country and home, Melbourne, Leitrim, upstate New York, Dublin, and finally Mayo. Retracing her journey into writing, the creative tension that accompanied her three books was something that she struggled with. This, coupled with the denial of her US visa, placed Marcia under stress. Even though divorced, Chris was still someone she confided in.
And she'd call me from Australia, she'd call me from wherever she was, she'd call me. And sometimes it was happiness like you would not believe on the phone, and other times it was not the person I ever met. But again, what could I do now? You know, the umbilical cord had been cut. And like I said, you know, it's amazing how easy it is to forget where everything came from and where it happened and what was done. But I mean, she was so motivated on the book. I mean, the attention. I mean, she got just so infatuated with the next book. It's consumed her. She became consumed by her book. Let's be real. I mean, she was my first true love, and of course I followed everything and tried to keep an eye on her the best way I could. I mean, which was like people would tell me what was going on. I didn't have that physical contact with her.
Marcia's second book, Rose Water and Soda Bread, failed to reach the heights of her debut novel. Yearning for that initial success, Marcia would spend the final 6 years of her life attempting to finish her third novel. During some of this time, she spent over a year in the village of Keshkerrigan in Leitrim, a place where her landlady Carmel Murphy and her husband Liam held out the hand of friendship to the then 32-year-old Iranian-born author.
So, initially we would have, myself and my husband, Liam, you know, invited Marcia in for dinner to the house. You know, very conscious she has arrived in this village where she knows nobody from another country. She's on her own. Invited her in for dinner, introduced her to some friends, brought her down to the pub. I think she came once with us, maybe twice. Would have continued to ask or send her a text, do you want to come down? Now, we didn't go that often, but, you know, we would have offered her the opportunity to come out with us. I suppose I was conscious we were the landlord, and we had to respect Marcia's right to live whatever way she wanted to. So not everyone wants to socialise. Not everybody needs to have a lot of company. We were just offering her the option if she wanted to. And she did take us up initially on things like, say, dinner, going to the cinema. She had dinner with another of my friends. She came to my friend's house for dinner another time. So there were, you know, definitely a number of occasions in the early months when Marcia socialised with us to a limited degree, but then it stopped. And I really don't know why. And I do think it, you know, the type of set up in Kesh, relatively easy type of place to, you know, make friends and get to know people, if that's what she had wanted to do.
After the first few months in Kesh, Marcia was rarely seen. For Christmas 2009, Carmel and her husband Liam bought Marcia a present of some driving lessons, hoping that she might get out of her apartment a little more. She never took those lessons, and in mid-2010, Marcia left Leitrim, landing some months later in Australia.
I knew by 2010 that the book was going to be, this is going to be even worse than the first two, you know? I knew it. The book was overwhelming her, and the reality was not there anymore. You know, everything and anything was either watching her, stalking her, or messing with her.
For Barbara, one of the lasting friendships that Marcia first made when she arrived in Dublin in 1998, there was little contact during those years, something that Barbara had grown accustomed to as part of their friendship. Towards the end of 2013, Marcia arrived at Barbara's home in Dublin with one focus, to finish her third book.
But she came, January 3rd, 2014, and then she stayed with us for 3 or 4 weeks. And it was still the third book. And then it was difficult. It was just, she would work nights or be up at night, and we wouldn't see her during the day at all. And that's very difficult in a small house. And my daughter was doing kind of exams and finishing stuff off. So, and it's a small enough house, you know, but she was very much, she was just like, I'm working, that's how I am, I worked, you know. And there were some great, like, you know, there was one or two evenings where we kind of met, you know, but otherwise it was really just she wouldn't see her. She was going to look for a place in Dublin. And then she said, she called me in work, said, no, I'm moving to Mayo. I said, are you sure? And it was our, I don't know how many times we had this conversation. And it was literally the same response again. She goes, you know me, you know, laughing off, not giving any more information. I'm moving to Mayo. I said, like, it's just been this reoccurring. So I came home that evening and she showed me, and it was a house by the sea she had seen on Daft, or My Home, one of the two sites I gave her. And yeah, it wasn't as charming now as, like, she would be very particular about, you know, where she'd live and how she dressed and everything. So it was just a bungalow by the, but it was by the beach, and but it was wet and it was miserable. And but she was just, no, that's it again. But then again, laughing it off again and go like, that's now, then I can really focus on writing. I've finished the book in Mayo, you know, that's how it should be, you know.
On January 18th, 2014, Marcia arrived to Lacanvi. She met the estate agent to get the keys of her chalet, stating that she wanted the house in this location to write a book. The last anybody saw of Marcia was towards the end of February. Her love affair with food had ended. The only remnants of food found in her chalet were empty crisp packets and empty chocolate bar wrappers. At some point around then, she sent an email to her father, Abbas.
I've spent the last 5 months working on the edit for my third book. It has been a painful process, to say the least. Hardly a night has passed that I have not woken up midway through sleep, body drenched in sweat, heart beating out the rhythms of some ancient tarantella inside my chest. My legs throbbed, both during the day and at night, the kind of throbbing that shook whatever seat I was on, and I looked like I had aged 10 years, eyes drooping, skin ashen, a vague recollection that I had not washed my hair for a week straight.
During the final weeks of Marcia's life, she continued the pattern of sleeping by day and writing by night. She was only seen once by her next-door neighbour in the neighbouring chalet across the path.
I'd never set eyes on her until one day I was in the kitchen and she happened to be sitting at her table in the dining room, and I could see right through, and she seemed to be working away, obviously writing. I knew that she was a recluse because we never saw her. Then I had noticed that there was nobody around the house, and I went into her shed where there were plastic bags full of rubbish, and I got on to the estate agent and advised her that the tenant obviously had moved out.
The last communication noted at the inquest into Marcia's death was dated April 10th, 2014. A text message she sent to her letting agent. I've been vomiting blood for the last few weeks. I'll get back to you in a few days to see what I'm going to do about things. I'm still pretty sick. The letting agent replied, asking if Marcia had been to the doctor. No response. Numerous calls and texts between April 12th and 23rd, still no response. On April 30th, at 10 past 7, the letting agent called to the chalet. The lights shone into the early morning light with no response at the door. They returned that afternoon, entering the house to find Marcia's badly decomposed remains on the bedroom floor. After the investigation and autopsy following a sudden death, Marcia's father Abbas and her ex-husband Chris followed her remains down the M4 motorway to a Dublin crematorium.
Marcia died, and I just mourn. Especially, it's not easy. You know, I remember I was after cremation, they gave me a box, and I put in my luggage, my backpack, in my backpack, and then walking from that cremation place, a church, to the hotel where I was staying. I can't express, I can't say what I was, you know, I was, what was my feeling, you know. My daughter in ash in my backpack. Marcia.
Marcia's funeral was a small one. Her mother and younger brother didn't travel from the US for her cremation. The distance that pervaded her life proved a barrier to a last reunion. Back in Australia, Abbas, Marcia's father, does what any father might do when they lose a child, begins to wonder what he could have done differently.
If I thought anything about our movement, what would happen if we were staying in Iran, if there was no revolution? Yes, we would go to United States, the same as all other people, and go back. That was the idea. Go to United States, study, get a master, come back, get good job, and live the life, you know, better than before. But it didn't happen. So we became without home, homeless, basically. And then when you don't know where is your home, you don't know what exactly to do, how to invest in your life, how, for what, for where.
Had Marcia wanted to engage in the communities she found herself in, she would have found people willing to do so. Marcia, suffering from poor mental health, alienated herself from everybody. She went to the most western point in Europe to find solace to complete her work, but failed and paid the ultimate price.
I think I'm still kind of trying to figure out, you know, this, you know, could have done things different, should have noticed, would have been able to, you know, should have just, but, you know, I've been over this before, like this kind of, why are you moving to the west of Ireland again? You know, so many times over the years we had that conversation and she was laughing it off and she was not old and she just made this decision and she was very firm in this decision. So I don't know, obviously she wasn't well, so would that have helped her? Would that have changed anything? She knew what she was doing. Do you know, going to go to Mayo and I'm going to live there and I'm going to finish the book.
It's not easy to slip through the cracks in life, but if someone is determined enough or unwell enough, it is possible.
It's like the demons brought her back there. It's just, you know, that was her demon. That, you know, I mean, Kirkpatrick is magical for people. It was her mountain. It was the isolation. She was never about isolation either, but, you know, she thought it was for the work and what, you know, she had to do it. And I mean, I feel that she was so alone. Which is the hard part. I feel that she had nobody in her life. It doesn't matter what I say or anyone says, there was nobody in her life. But I feel that she was just so alone. She had nobody. And that was her muse. I think her best friend was that mountain.
Next month, Marcia's third and final book, titled The Margaret Thatcher School of Beauty, will be published, completed by her father Abbas. Her first novel, Pomegranate Soup, is currently being developed into a film. Even in death, Marcia remains a wanderer, her ashes resting in southern Australia.